I'm very excited to have Belinda Botsolis with me on the podcast today. Belinda is a genuine authority in the real estate sector. And to give you a picture of Belinda's credentials, Belinda holds a Bachelor of Business with a major of Property Economics, and professional affiliations include an associate member of the Australian Property Institute. Belinda is a registered tax agent specializing in tax depreciation schedules and property-related valuation reports. Belinda boasts an impressive 17 years in the property industry, having inspected roughly 15,000 properties and valued nearly $12 billion in real estate assets. Belinda shares her knowledge across her social media network through the account The Valuer, which has amassed a huge following of tens of thousands of people. And today we are fortunate to have Belinda share her sights with you on the luxury property market here in Australia. Belinda, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm good, yourself?
Good. Answer. So I'm going to ask you, what, when you hear the word market value, what's the market? Like, what's the market?
It's for me, it's what someone's prepared to pay. You know, and for us as an agents, what we do, the approach that we take is to find true value in our eyes is we need a couple of things. We need competition from people. So we want to make sure a lot of people know about it and that that people are competing for the property. So yep. It's not just a very singular thing where if a homeowner, for example, was to have, I've got a friend of a friend who wants to buy my house. You know, I want to have a situation where they have to compete with other people to really find what they're prepared to pay. I need to have someone that's a kind of a bit emotional, that really loves it. You know, it's not a situation. Sometimes people will buy a car or a property when it's not quite the right fit for them, but it'll do, you know. So yep. I need to have that emotion and that competition. And when I have those two things, that's when I believe I've found market value. You know, and not to the situation where I'm kind of like, you know, leaning people to hyper emotional or, but you know, they've reached that little bit further deeper into their pockets to pay the price that they feel comfortable with. They have those two ingredients. So that's market value to me.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I think you're spot on. You probably explain it a little different to the way I would, and explain it to a little different how somebody else would, or a buyer or a seller. But what I think you touched on is so important that whoever's listening to this understands that market comes down to two human beings making a transaction, a willing buyer and a willing seller. And that's exactly what you explained in your own words. Yeah. So I think once you have someone that's prepared to put their property on the market, and the market is the willing buyers out there. It's not some big machine. It's not some fancy person behind a curtain and they're like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to increase the market and go back on the machine and start playing with the dials, and all of a sudden the market goes up or goes down. As much as people think the government has a hand in this and, you know, policy has a hand in this, that is like a small ingredient in the cake. It is the human beings. And that's why we can never really predict the market, you know, because human beings, we react. I mean, look at us during lockdown. People were doing stuff and you're going, what are you doing? And then there's other people saying, well, this is how I'm reacting because I feel I'm under duress, I'm under stress, I'm scared. And you know, we can't ever predict how the human beings are going to react. So put us in this pressure cooker of life and everything that we're going through at the moment, interest rates, inflation, cost of living. Some people are affected, some aren't. Some people care, some don't. But as human beings, we you know, there's that push and pull and we react. And that's why the market does what it does. Without, you can have 15 economists give you 15 predictions or 15 banks give you 15 outcomes, and it never happens. Because
that would make your job harder, I'd imagine. And when, for example, during COVID, you gave that, you know, the world was going crazy. And as agents, we started selling properties for premiums, like numbers that were just blowing our minds.
Yeah.
Every sale that we did just seemed to be higher and higher. And, you know, we couldn't explain it. It was just these willing buyers were prepared to pay these crazy prices. And then, you know, that person has to get a loan, incomes valuer, and they need to stack this deal up. And every time, you know, Val came around, and we're kind of, as agents, we're holding our breaths, please stack up our deal. And what we found is initially there was this kind of, you know, trepidation in prices, and then kind of we had Val gaps, and then all of a sudden it just kind of went, you know what, it's like the value is, we're just going to let go of this because we figure that, you know, the market's doing what it's doing. But then what I've noticed recently is I'm starting to get Val gaps again. It's kind of like, you know, those influences on perhaps conditions, the economists, the government, all this feedback is not only kind of adjusting the mindset of the consumer, but also the professionals that are involved in the transaction too. Would you see, is that how you saw it? Is that kind of, am I on the right track there? Am
I love hearing your, I love hearing your opinion on this because you're coming from an agent. Every time you bang on, but it's just like, it's coming from a different perspective. It's tough being a value because a lot of people don't understand. A lot of the times our hands are tied because of the bank. So let's say you're Joe Smith, whatever, and I come and value your property. It's your property, you own it, and you feel a sense of this is my home. I'm paying for this report, but you're paying the report to the valuer. The valuer works for the bank. The bank is paying the valuer, and you're paying the bank. But
this is refinance situation.
Refinance, a purchase, a sale, whatever you want, whatever the valuer is. Unless you personally engaged with that valuer, your letter of engagement is between yourself personally and the valuer, you're considered a third party. And our valuation is not extended to you. You cannot sue us. You cannot go, that valuation's wrong, I'm suing you. Okay? You cannot rely on that report. The bank, however, can. So they're saying, we're not the experts. We're about to lend $1 million on this property. You're our eyes. You're our ears on the ground. Go do the inspection and report back. I want to know everything. I want to know the condition. I want to know if there's anything that's going to affect the property, more so than just selling to the open market. So that's how we base our valuation. Now, at the beginning of COVID, and I don't think I've ever spoken about this, I work for a large valuation company. You know how you got the big four banks? I work for one of the big four val firms. And we had an all-in meeting, and we basically were told the banks are preparing for a 30%, 20 to 30% market drop, okay? It's not that we want you to be conservative, but please understand that your previous market evidence that you're going to base your valuation as at today's date is at different market parameters, is at different market conditions, and the market is responding in a different way. So we have no evidence currently representing what's happening in the world right now because it's just happened. We're in lockdown, right? We need you to make sure that you are like, it's almost like your spidey senses are heightened and you have to be aware of everything.
I bet. It wouldn't have been an easy thing.
No. And I'm like, the world's going to end. Like, I'm just going to have to buy a bunker and, you know, buy some baked beans, buy some water and toilet paper because you couldn't find any. So you have to buy toilet paper and go underground. I'm like, the world's ending. I was literally thinking this is it because we were told this prior from the banks. And I'm like, what do the banks know that they don't? Are they collapsing? Are they scared to lend money? Like what aren't we telling the people, right? Anyway.
So on that. So I remember the listing that I had when COVID first happened as well. And I kind of said to my client, similar thing. I said, people are saying there's going to be a 20, 30% adjustment here. Like, you know, cause they're looking to me for advice. And I'm like, well, that's what I'm getting told. That's what the industry inside is. That's the kind of the word amongst the professionals. Let's see how this develops over the next couple of weeks, but it's not looking good, but yeah, please continue.
Yeah. And I think it was probably like a week or so later. I saw this is probably the first time in my life I felt like proper fear. I saw the line outside Centrelink. And it went on and on and around and around. Everyone just lost their jobs because things shut down. Yeah. And I've gone, people going to survive? Like, these people have mortgages. That's the first thing I thought. How are they paying? They've lost their jobs. the bank's going to reap mass repossession of homes. This is it. It's happening.
That's what your feelings were.
Yeah, straight away. I was like, they can't pay their mortgage, because at the time I was like, I was working. I had very young kids. I was building. So I was in the middle of a build, and I'm losing my house. Just lose my house. Just sit. That's it. And I was like, well, yeah, switch straight out. I'm like, because they're going to lose their jobs. They can't come on site. How they're going to build my home? The bank's going to collapse. The world's going to collapse. I'm just going to lose my home. Like, I just thought, how are these people going to pay for their mortgages? And if they can't pay the bank, then how are the bank going to then lend money out? And then who's going to buy these homes if they aren't working? And then how are they going to borrow them? So this is the mind of a valuer, yeah. Okay? Like, probably no one else in the world thought this except for valuer, because my brain
was thinking it too as a real estate agent. You know, I just launched a new business, and, you know, our business was like 6 months old. You know, new company, and we're running off the smell of an oily rag. You know, it's kind of 100%. Like, you know, cash flow's low, and it's all of a sudden it's like boom, and we're like, we just started listing properties as well. So we're sort like, you know, the money hadn't really flown in yet because we got this stock that we're carrying, and then you know, what do we do? Do we like work these vendors down? Do we kind of like, are we going to have no buyers to work at all? How are we going to bring these deals together to get these properties transacted? We're not allowed to show the properties. We're not allowed to open them. We're not allowed to do inspections, all this stuff. And so the same thing that you're feeling, we're feeling as well in the industry, and stressing us out.
Yeah. So we had a letter. I've still got that letter. I'm very proud of that letter. I got a letter saying that we are essential workers. And we are essential to the finance sector, because homes were seen as essential. You have to live.
We got that too.
So you have to live, and people have to sell. People have to. You can't stop. Like, there's some transactions already in motion. The trajectory of these motions are happening. People have to move. People have to sell. People have to buy. You can't stop life. As much as they stopped life, they can't stop life itself. So people stopped working, and they had to refinance, see if they could draw equity. They paused loans. So we were still out and about traveling, going to inspections, coming home, face masks, you name it.
No one was allowed to be on site or something, yet they had to leave the house when you came in. Is that
you got a lot of we asked them 101 questions, and they ask us 101, you know, have you been to Wuhan? Have you been traveling? I'm talking about early days here. I'm talking about mate, I'm like, oh, I think I might have COVID. I'm like, whatever, had it already three times, like I'm fine, like just if you want, I don't care. Like, now I'm like sneezing my face. I don't care. Back then, oh my God, I was like sanitizing, washing, like I'd wash the cereal from the box because I took it from Coles. I'm like, I don't know who else has touched this. So,
yeah.
But now I'm like, oh, whatever, you know. So it's very deep. But I'm talking about those early days. And then, you're right. We were very conservative. This is probably the only time in my career I would say that I was the most conservative ever. And then slowly we had evidence, market evidence as the market moved. So we relied on 3 months worth of evidence, and then all of a sudden 3 turned into 6, and then 6 turned into 12. And then we're like, I don't know where you were going with this 30%. And this is where I learned personally very quickly that You can do whatever you want with the numbers, but human beings, this is where I learned that the market really does come down to how we react. We adapt, we adjust. Everyone using the word pivot, but no one pivots like the human race. You know, whenever something happens, collectively, we just adjust. So when everyone's like, how can the market go even further? I was like, well, people change, people do things. And what you find is like, you know, money comes and it moves on, and then a new set of money comes and it moves on, a new set of money comes. There will always be the top end and there'll always be the bottom end, and it just shifts up. It just shifts up. So that's why you find, how can this area be worth that much? Well, they have money, they couldn't afford that suburb, so they're moving down. And then it just shifts up. And that's why the top will never have a ceiling. because the top will always have money and they'll always push it up, always push it up, always push it up. There'll be a ceiling for today. I value in Sydney and I did the eastern suburbs for a long part of my career. I remember when I first started, I was so intimidated. I'm like, how do they get the money? Where's the money coming from? And I was like, surely, surely this is it. Surely it can't go anymore. And looking back now, it's probably tripled from where I first started. So a $2.5 million house is now like it will double to five and now five to 10. Yeah. If you told me, Belle, this in 10 or 15 years' time is going to be worth $10 million, I would laugh at you. I'd be like, no way. Where do you think, like, there's a tree with money? This is not happening. Happens. Mm. So the top end, the prestige market, has no ceiling. And if it hasn't, especially in a city like Sydney, okay, Sydney's a major capital city. I mean, Packer put a casino. He could have put it anywhere in Australia, but he puts it in the heart of the city. That's where the money is. Money follows money. So he's got a penthouse for like $190 million. Would I buy it? No. There's a $200 million jackpot, I think, with the Powerball. If I won that, if I won $1 billion, I probably still wouldn't buy it, but somebody will because there's money out there. So money brings in money and it's like a magnet. It just pulls it up. So then all the other suburbs, they get pulled up. And that's why Sydney is this beast of a city. People, I've lived here my whole life. I've like grown up here from birth, right? So this is all I know. And I get, Sydney, it's terrible. I hate Sydney. Why would you live here? It's a crap. And then I'm like, okay, well, then why is the demand still there? So it's a real beast of a city. People leave, of course, but once they leave, Brennan, they can never come back in because the market is too strong and just keeps going because the market end at the top pulls it. So when you have small regions, they don't have that prestige and they don't have that top end money to pull it. So you just sort of sits there and plateaus because the money is a bit. When I talk about money, a lot of people forget and they just think about the property. They forget about the money. It's actually a vessel for money. People earn money, they buy the property. People sell it, they make money. But with the top end, they are in business and money just keeps coming in. But when you have a ceiling in a regional town because all the jobs that you can't find those top end prestige jobs, and if you do, you either are very, very lucky, but it's not, it's the exception, not the rule. So when you have that, the market doesn't really move or you need an influx of money and that's where it comes from Sydney. Tree change, sea change.
It does come from Sydney. Yeah, it does.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. I'm talking about the regions. It comes from we opened up a mining town. So people go to these courses and they're like, yeah, but there's a Bunnings opening up and a school and a hospital. I'm like, yeah, cool. I'm like, awesome. I'm being serious. Like it's awesome. There are people to buy your property. I said, but how much do they earn? And I said, this isn't anything to do with the people, anything to do. But if you're a Bunnings, you're maybe earning minimum wage, like retail minimum wage. I mean, if you're a nurse, you kind of get a ceiling and then you have to fight tooth and nail to the government to get a pay rise. Same as a school. There's only one principal, a handful of doctors in a hospital. Everyone else, their pay is plateaued for ages until you fight with the government. So where is this excess of money coming from that means that your property is going to double every 10, 15 years?
Yeah.
Unless it's an influx or an injection of money coming from outside in. But having a Bunnings or a school is not enough.
So when you're supporting a client to give them the skills to perform an analysis on a marketplace, the driver you're looking for is employment.
I think that's a big, because I'm looking at the humans. Who are the humans buying these properties? Where do they work? Where do they live? Where do they spend? What do they do with their money?
And you're thinking about that as an exit strategy, right? So like it's kind of, you want to forecast that exit strategy in the future, perhaps that is there going to be that employment driver that's going to go up, 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 that's going to magnetize and pull the value with it. That employment growth. And then, you know, so in that 10 years, you'll have that, you know, that security or that comfort of forecasting that this is where the property is going to lead to.
Yeah. Or is this little area the B grade suburb to the A grade suburb that everybody aspires to? So they can't quite afford this. So the money dribbles down. You know, those suburbs. So
do you like the aspirational suburb or do you like the B grade?
Aspirational. Yeah. But if you've got a really good aspirational suburb, attached to this B grade that gets the money that dribbles down on the overflow, that's great. It pulls you up, right? But if there's no, yeah, it pulls the B up. Yeah, but if you're the A and you're not that great, then who's pulling you up? And how are you going to get that long term? You'll get these like injection of growth, right? I'll give you a real life example. My in-laws have a house at the South Coast in Jervis Bay. They bought this place in 1990 for $110,000. Cool, right? In 2014, they were going to sell it. They're like, oh, you know, we're going into the pension and, you know, might affect our pension, blah, blah. The agent said 2014, so 34 years later, $230,000. Yep, $120,000 growth. And we went down to Himes Beach, which apparently has some of the whitest sand in the world. And I went to my husband, they're not selling this. look at this place. Are you kidding me? For 230, like I'm from Sydney, like 230 grand gets you a parking spot. I'm like, we'll help them pay. Like we'll pay for everything. They just need to own the house. We'll pay for everything. We'll, you know. I'm like, we're not leaving. So we to this day, we still holiday there. Between 2014 and now, it's worth close to $700,000. It made all its frigging growth in the space of 10 years. It doubled and then doubled and doubled.
That's Queensland. So just to swing back to what you said about 100%. And you're talking about when COVID first happened and there was this, you know, perception out there from the analysts that the market was going to go down 20-30%. Then it didn't happen, right? And you mentioned that you watched the trends over that 3 months. So as agents, we were in that same position as you. The market's going to go down, and we're like great agents out there. Thought to ourselves, we're going to have to bend this curve, you know, like for us to survive too, we're going to have to get properties transacted. We're going to have to get them sold and we're going to have to get a good price because we're going to have to set these trends. We're going to have to, you know, I'm not saying that we kind of,
you did too much of a good job, Brennan. What did you guys do? You set the freaking market up.
Well, I have to say that I believe that the great agents out in the marketplace did play a hand in that, because what we saw very quickly is, because we were the ones carrying the stock, is the inquiry level didn't really go down too much. Actually, the inquiry level kind of went up a little bit. And what we noticed was there was a little bit more of an urgency. And when you, with this sort of competition, emotion, and urgency is another good thing about making a quick decision. But people, as you said, they were very emotional. They were nervous and scared. That's an emotion, you know. So that
when you guys are like playing on it a bit, like reeling them in gently.
Well, you know, we were in the same position. We needed to help these people get their properties transacted. These people that were making these moves, like this one particular client, and she had to go. You know, this one property that I'm thinking of in particular, and I remember. We got that notification about the essential as well. We got a framework in Queensland about how we're allowed to conduct our inspections. We had to like stagger all of our buyers, this and that. And what we did is we're only allowed to show one buyer the property at a time. But from a time management perspective, we got the other buyers to wait in their cars on the street.
PTSD going through all this again. I can imagine.
It reminded me. I'd forgotten about it. And it all started coming back to me, this one house. And I remember.
It's like therapy. We should hang out more often and just get it out.
This is what happened. And I haven't even really even talked to anyone about it either. So it is kind of like therapy. But to have that ingredient about competition, we made everybody in their cars line up down the street because we still felt like people were trying to say, oh, no one wants to buy a house. We heard the market's going down. But when they saw each other lined up in their cars and they had to wait an hour in their car for the next car to come down and down and down for their turn to see this house, they emotion, competition, boom, the property sold. And we're like, so then we set that benchmark and then we're like,
yes,
we communicated that story, sold, 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 great price, bang, bang, bang. And then, you know, sent it out to the database, and it just started this, the wheel started turning. And then all of a sudden, the next deal. And then, but the interesting thing was the buyers that were all in that line, they weren't the ones that lost their jobs, because the ones that kind of lost their jobs, I found, they were the like cafes,
yeah,
kind of travel agents, and they weren't our buyers anyway, you know, and like it was sad and like it's horrible to have lost your job, but they weren't the, you know, the value was still, you know, everyone got put on, you know, job keeper and this and that. So there was still money flying around.
Yes.
Actually, the you know, you're an economist, like all this economy money pouring in from the government and propping everybody up. And, you know, my mum, she said to me, with her business, they have, plant hire company. So they hire plants. And she said, they made more money during COVID because they weren't allowed to get into the buildings, their staffing was all casual, dropped down, because they weren't allowed to really get into the buildings to do anything. So their profit margin increased during COVID because everyone's on contract. They still had to pay for their plants, but they didn't have to go in and service them and muck around with them as much because so their wages went down, which is kind of a major expense for them.
Happened a lot to a lot of people, which is probably the snowball effect to this inflation.
It is. I saw it firsthand, and I remember telling my wife, I'm like, there's way too much money out there, you know, and like each property, as I said, was transacting for more and more and more. And what I was noticing was when Nana sold the house, and because a lot of these people were downsizers, so Nana sold the house, she got, as you mentioned, she would have only got 232 four or 5 years earlier or 6 years earlier. All of a sudden, she's got 750, 800. She's just won the lotto.
So
the kids are getting pushed all this cash. She's giving money to everyone and she's running out, you know, buying, just going nuts with her cash, right? All that money's bouncing around. So that fabricated increase in value, that chunk of money just bounced around the economy and it's slowing down now. And I'm noticing it as well where, you know, people aren't quite getting that. They're still getting a great price, but they're not getting that crazy number now because we're in this sort of level sort of time. And I think, you know, general expenses and living expenses, all that sort of stuff have kind of like increased enough to sort of soak and sponge and soak up some of those things. So, but we're still seeing sort of good numbers and we're still seeing like a plateau, particularly here in Queensland, sort of really put a kind of modest needle heading north. Is that your take on today versus where we were, say, you know, 14, 16, 18 months ago? That is it level in Sydney or is it kind of the needle heading south a little bit? What's your take on the market at the moment?
Okay, the Sydney market, I think I just saw a report yesterday from CoreLogic that Sydney's back to peak. So peaked in 22 and then we had that downturn. It's had a 100% recovery. It's come back.
Right.
Yeah. So we are better and it's never been more expensive to buy in Sydney ever. We've actually recovered.
Region or micro within the individual suburbs?
So the thing with Sydney is, it's funny because we're supposed to be talking about luxury homes. I don't think we've touched into a single thing about luxury homes in this podcast, but I think it's the okay, because when they talk about the median house price and the average house price, what typically happens is they'll take the average is, they'll add it all together and then they'll kind of divide it. And that's why sometimes you'll get the average price in Sydney is 1.6 and sometimes you get it at 1.2. Depends if it's the median or the average. Now, because the gap between the prestige top-end Sydney market and everything else is so damn big, the haves and have-nots, and it's getting bigger and bigger, I feel like our average is really getting propped up because of the prestige market.
I believe so too. Yeah, I believe so too.
Like, I cannot believe where the money came from. Like, I hear stories of sold around COVID, before COVID for 16, just transacted for 30, 32. That's a lot of money.
And I think we haven't really been talking on luxury market. I think it's interesting this how this conversation is going. But I think those factors lead up to this point now that we're talking about the prestige market, because those people still made money, you know, like those people that are buying those properties, they did really, really well. And they've been,
especially if they were in property, like if they were developers, builders, architects, agents, they made so, there's so much money in this city, Brennan. I cannot, cafes full, shops full, like anywhere you go, like you go, I've got a group of like young, like my girl group is quite large and we like going out like to restaurants. Some of us are married with kids, not so much money. Others don't have kids, great jobs, lots of money. So we go to really nice places and I'm looking around going, we couldn't get a reservation to this place. Like you get a main meal at $65 and here I am going, I have that and that. Like I'm trying to add up how much it's cost. People are laughing. They don't have a care in the world. There is so much money out there in this city. And I think that's, and then you have people at the bottom end seriously struggling. So, and that's how this city has, it gets divided and divided and divided and divided. So the top end, there's just going to always be money there. And don't forget, it's not like somebody comes up and it's like, oh, I'm going to buy that $30 million property off the bat. They've probably sold their $22.5 million property. You know, like they've sold to upgrade. It's not like they're just coming up from scratch. Like, oh, I'm just coming as a first home buyer.
Yeah, it's not.
They've
like
inherited.
Yeah.
They've got money. They're going to renovate. They've got businesses. They, you know, they need to offset all this money they're making in their business somehow. And I can guarantee you, so much of that is bought in a trust. Because one, buying in a trust and that top end is probably the closest thing that you can get to laundering money in this country legally. Mm-hmm. And it's not you're doing anything illegal. I always say, don't hate the players, hate the game. If you are playing the game legitimately, you know that famous quote by Packer, and he's sitting there in court and he's like, I don't want to pay a single cent more in tax that I don't have to. It's because he knew how to play the system. He didn't do anything wrong. Well, if he did, he, you know, he's in court and he's like, he did nothing wrong. Why? Because he had a team of incredibly smart people behind him laundering the money legally. So the rich know how to do that because they've got the money to get incredible advice to learn how to do that. And they've got inheritance. Not everybody, but I see a lot of the times I'll do a valuation, it's in a trust. Fun fact, I valued Nicole Kidman's property years ago in a trust. We did the valuation when Russell Crowe sold his property at Woolloomooloo and the buyer bought his property. It didn't say Russell Crowe. It was in a trust. So the rich or the wealthy protect their assets because if they get sued, they can lose their assets. So they do it for asset protection. They do it for like moving money around. So there's a lot that you can do. It's not like they go to the bank and they're like, hi, I'd like to apply for $32 million, please, for a loan. There's a lot in the background that happens to get them where they are. And that's how it just recycles.
So a lot of these deals don't necessarily need vals, right? But it might be a situation where it's like there's a divorce or there's some kind of, you know, legal matter or there's something else that forces the requirement. It's not like they're needing a val to get a loan. They're not getting a loan for $32 million. And
no, sometimes they just need it a bit topped up. And their LVR is really big, but the bank still want to secure the loan. And when you're dealing with that much money, you know, if you're out by 10% at $32 million, you're out by $3.5 million. And that's a lot of money for the bank.
Yeah, right. I see. Okay.
So they just get it to resecure the loan. And there's a lot of off-market transactions at that end of the market in this city as well.
True.
Okay, because there's a handful of buyers that can afford that real, I'm talking these $20 to $30 million properties upwards. Very small amount that transact. It's not like an open market. We have mum and dad lining up down the street. There's a small market that sell and a small market that buy, and they are known to all the agents at that top end. So a lot of the time it's just very quietly advertised. You know, you go out to your network, you go out to your buyer's agent networks. Most people buy with buyer's agents at that top end.
Right.
They're just like, look, I don't really have the time. You know, I've got the money. You do the hard work. You do all the due diligence stuff for me, please, and then come and report back to me and let me know what's on the market and then we'll go at it together. So you get these buyer's agents quietly go on the market to their agents. I got a buyer about that, you know, 20 to 30 million mark, but for 30 million, they want this. And if they're not going to pay that, they want this. Don't call me back until you got something for me. And there's a lot of this quiet, which is a pain in the backside for a valuer, because then we've got no internal photos, we've got no market evidence, we've just all of a sudden the sale pops up on RP data and I'm like, what do you mean? Where did this come from? I need more details. I don't even know who the agent is. So then you pick up the phone and you start ringing around.
Yeah.
So property.
When the deal just appears.
Yeah, because it's
completely off market.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a big thing about pre-market and off-market. So a lot of agents always plan on putting it on the market, you know this, and they'll just massage their current database. You know, anybody out there looking to buy, always intended to get on the market, which is like a pre-market campaign. But true off-markets, as you know, there's a lot of like never really, they're like, I have no rush to sell. If I get my price, I will sell. But I don't have any intention of ever like putting it on. Very discreet, that end of the market, that prestige end. So that's why you go on RP data and you just do a white, like a, you put your fishing net out and you try and get all the sales evidence in the air, and then all of a sudden you're like, that's a sale in like Dover Heights or Vaucluse for 22 million. I didn't see this being advertised. There's no marketing on it. It's probably off market. I know three of the really great agents in the area. I'm going to give them a call, see if they know anything. And then they might not know.
If you're trying to do a comparison to that property, but there's no images, there's no information around it. It's like a, you know, it's just a number there.
An enigma. Like,
how does my property compare to that property? Yeah.
And you'd be surprised how nosy people get. Oh, I heard from the lady at the supermarket or the lady at the cafe or my partner at yoga, who walks my dog, that the lady down the road sold her house off market for 38 million. And if she sold her house at 38 million,
yeah.
Oh, I'm at least 45. And you're like, what property? I'm like, how do you know this? It's not even on anywhere. And then after a little while, it pops up and then you call them back and like, hi, remember me? We spoke. Do you know who the agent was that sold it? And it gets tricky. So, yeah, that top end, I think, is not all properties, but there's a larger percentage of that prestige market in Sydney that they do have a healthy amount of off-market sales. And that's why it's important that if you are an active buyer in that market, say you don't want to use a buyer's agent, I think it's so important your relationship with the agent. Make sure you communicate with them what you want. Make sure you tell them, I want to know first. If you have something come up, put me in your database. Treat me like a buyer's agent. I'm ready to go. And when you get that warm lead, it's encouraging for an agent because you're like, oh, this one's ready to go. They don't have to muck around with pre-approval and they don't know what they want. I mean, you can probably shed some light. It's probably the best type of client to have, those that actually know what they want. When they go in and they're like, oh, no, actually, I don't like this. And you're like, but you told me you wanted a Queenslander that was cool. And yeah. And then they get through and you're like, what? You know, so I think.
The amount of times that you'll run into a buyer or give them a call and you'll say, hey, I found the exact thing that you're looking for. And they go, oh, we changed our mind. Now we ended up buying this over here. And we're like, hey, that had nothing to do with the brief that you gave me. And I've been trying to find you the perfect property. Yeah.
That's why I reckon being a buyer's agent will be really hard because you get the brief and then they go off and then it just comes back as something completely different. So
and it would be really hard. We work with a lot of buyer's agents and they're trying to find unicorns that just don't exist. You know, the client's trying to, because a lot of the buyer's agents we work with, they're looking for investment properties. So they're basically trying to buy in 2018 prices, but rent them in 2024 rental rates. You know, they want to have that. They want to have today's rent and 5 year ago prices, you know, and it's just kind of impossible to find. And they're kind of asking, are we just sort of giggling like, no, that property doesn't exist. You know that. But there's one question before I let you go. There's one question I really wanted to get an understanding of in terms of your process as a valuer, because as agents, we often get called out to the homeowners. They'll ring us up, Brennan, can you come out and do an appraisal on my property? I've had, you know, yourself, and I've got, you know, had two other agents previously. I'll go out there and I'll apply, you know, what I believe to be the best process to give them an indication of the market value for their property. And then I'll sort of say to them, hey, you know, have you had, what's some other opinions you've received? And then, but often what we'll get is this number from an agent that's just absolutely ridiculous, that's got no evidence to support it. And it's hard for that homeowner because they're like, who's giving me the right information here? Are you just being conservative? Is this other person just giving me this number to win the business? In your view as a professional valuer, what is the correct process a homeowner could take to value their own property, or an agent should take to determine the value of a property?
Yeah, great question. So a lot of people think that value is undervalue. You probably get that a lot, and like, the valuer doesn't know what they're doing. So the hard thing about a valuer is they can only really value your property based on comparable sales. So we can't be that agent. Sometimes, hand on heart, we properly, legitimately, I promise you, we know it can sell for more. We just can't prove it. We know it's a great home. I reckon if this sells, it'll probably break a record. I have no evidence. I can't support
because it's
it.
It's got to be a record. Like there's no, it, when you're dealing with a property that's a unique property that probably would set a record, unless you've got a comparable to support it.
And we're giving that as evidence to the bank. Okay. Because if we say it's a $3 million property and then they lend upon that valuation, let's just say, and then there's a mortgagee in possession, they take possession and then it sells for 2.6, but they lent 2.9. Right? They lent almost 90%, whatever it is, 95%. And then they go, hello, Ms. Botsolis, we'll see you in court because we relied on your professional document as security for this loan. We based our assessment on security to lend them the money. You were wrong. If you weren't wrong and you didn't do your due diligence properly, we wouldn't have lent the money. We'll see you in court, prove it to the judge.
So they're suing you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Every single, we do risk management modules once a year. Our PI insurance is ridiculous. Like I started working for myself, my single-handedly biggest expense, I don't do mortgage work. I don't do commercial. I don't do anything other than, because I'm also a registered tax agent, I just do capital gains, stamp duty, family law, the really, really like low risk work, and my insurance is still up here. I don't do development sites. I can tell you what to do. I just don't want to put my name on that report. I don't want to get sued because I can't have cover from my PI. So an agent, their opinion is not legally binding. It's not a legal document. So I would say to that homeowner, ask your agent, are you prepared to sign that on a legal document? And if I don't sell for that price, are you prepared to sit in front of a judge and justify that? And I think the way I say is with a valuer, we don't go to court. I've said this before. Sorry if you've heard it. I say we don't go to court and say, I swear, Your Honor, I didn't kill that person. I was at home asleep. Just take my word for it. I promise. I'm an upstanding citizen. I go to church every Sunday. I pay my bills and I volunteer at the local soup shop. I'm a good person. Please trust me. Okay. Yeah, you seem trustworthy. Next case. I need evidence. I need CCT footage. I need an alibi. I want to know, were your fingerprints on site? They don't just let you go. It's a, like evaluation. And with market evidence, show me support my property. Now, the thing is, when we value property, it's a snapshot as at today's date. Exactly how we walk into the property, it's not dressed for sale. It doesn't have its lawn mowed meticulously. It's not painted. So when you see as an agent the home, you don't just see the home, but in your mind, you also see its potential with a little bit of a cleanup and a facelift. We don't. We're like, bang, snapshot today. That's it.
Yeah, you can't.
Because when, no.
What it could be, it's what it is now, right now.
And it has to be vacant possession. So the thing is, furniture can make it look lovely, but when an agent takes over a mortgagee in possession property, the bank need it sold quickly. They kind of don't have time to touch it up, to fix it up, to pay furniture. They just want it sold. And usually mortgaging sales, they people know it's a distressed sale and it's not. So we've got to be pretty brutal and go based on the evidence with no fluff involved, absolutely no fluff. It's like for a woman, you wake up in the morning, no makeup, okay? You don't get time to put your eyelashes on and fix your hair. I do not look like this from this morning, but that's how we value it. It's like, this is who you are. You know, strip it down. And that's how we value the home. And that's why sometimes I'm like, I know I can sell for more. Like I got my home valued literally 2 days ago and I'm like, oh, it's worth this. And the agent got the val back. And I was like, what a valuers are stupid. What do they know? Like, you know, so conservative. But then I spent the time to look at sales evidence properly. And I'm like, yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, I see. Okay. All right. Okay. I see what you did there. And I put my, like, I got it because he had no, there was nothing to support my figure. There was like nothing around. Yeah, there was a sale up here, but nothing that was going to support my figure. I just thought, I knew that if I dressed it up really well and I put it on the market and we put a really great campaign and I did some social media, like, oh, buy my house, we might get a good price. But no, that's not what the valuer's job is. That's what the agent's job is, but not the valuer's.
And it's interesting. Like I had a similar situation recently trying to buy a new property with our super. So we had a property in our super. We sold it. We were sort of buying our next one. And we found what we felt was a great property. In a marketplace, there's not many sales, not many transactions. Pretty rare to get a property for sale in there. We thought, fantastic. We jumped on it, put it under contract. And because we're buying in our super, we kind of had a tight, you know, LVR on that. You know, we needed this to stack up. And because there was a lack of comparables, the val gap was huge. There was a massive gap. And we went to fight and they weren't fighting. And they just went, nah, that's it. And so we couldn't go through with the property because the gap was too wide. We couldn't top enough cash up to make it work.
Do you want me to give you a tip for your next property?
Yes.
Okay. Please. If that ever happens again, approach it like you would a detective. Get your evidence, get your data, get your argument. You're going to court, right? Have a really good case. You're up against this person in court. Think of it that way because that's how they treat their valuation. They could go to court for this legitimately. It's a legal document that they're signing. So if you have present to them your justification. Mm-hmm. So go and meet the valuer on site. Hi, I'm Brennan Hill. Nice to meet you. Mate, I respect your opinion. This is going to be your opinion on your valuation. I don't want to get involved in that. You got to do what you got to do. I understand it's for the bank. It's for security. But, mate, just so you understand why I justified this price, these are, and I know it's hard to get sales. These are my sales evidence. This is how I analyze them. This is what I understood the market was doing. We don't care what you think the market will do in the future. It's a snapshot as at today's date.
I think that was a factor. And interestingly with this one, and you mentioned it earlier on about how I'm a third party to the val. So they wouldn't actually even have a conversation with me. So fortunately, my broker.
Unless you get them before they sign, because once they sign and if they change their opinion, their PI insurance will be pissed.
Yeah, they're like, that was the issue we had, and we were buying this particular property remotely. And what I'd done, see, as an agent, what I do is when I'm selling a property is when the val's booked, I'll take my comparables and my.
We love that. Thank you.
I take that, and I try and teach my agents to do that. A lot of agents will send their assistants to do the bank val or the.
We hate that.
Yeah, and
it's like you guys got. We're getting $200 for this. You're getting $22,000. The least you can do is come and give us some respect and meet us on site.
Yeah, and I actually said to the agent this deal. I'm like, please, mate, go take my comparison. Yes. I prepared the report that I would normally take if it was my listing. And I said, go along, and then he did it. And then I asked him like when the val came out, did you give him the report? He said, no, I was kind of just waited in my car. And I'm like, oh my god. But anyway, fast forward, right? So. We missed out on the deal. A cash buyer came along, paid the price that we paid, secured the property, cash, you know, no finance. All of a sudden, the values now in that neighborhood have been set by that benchmark.
Yeah.
But it was kind of like it took the cash transaction to set the bar. And it was kind of like, and we were sort of talking earlier on about, you know, when the market first happened and how these things get set, this and that. It's kind of like it takes a cash deal sometimes, or like you said, an off-market transaction.
Yeah.
It just kind of pops up to kind of recalibrate, you know, where, okay, yes, that must be true market value because someone was prepared to pay it. There was no outside influences from banks and politics and this and that. That person just wanted to buy that house because they've transacted. They've got the money. They don't care what anyone says. They're buying the property for that number.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, that's what it's worth.
Yeah, and it's hard too because I've had people say, oh, but this area is expected to get, you know, so-and-so migration. We're getting, you know, 700,000 in migration. And guess what? The government turned off the tap. So if you're basing all your numbers and you're basing it off a hypothetical, you're playing in a bit of a dangerous. So people are like, oh, but, you know, this, we would do a development valuation and hypothetical. So the bank want to know what is the property worth when it's completed, factoring in everything. But at today's date, it's not going to be finished for 2 years. So they do not want us to have a crystal ball and project. But what happens is there are some investment companies and what they'll do is they'll go, oh, you know, if it's growing at 6% a year in 2 years' time, that's what it's worth. And they base all their feasibility on that hypothetical assumption.
Future potential value.
Yes. Right. Where we don't. Everything we do is at today's value. So because just like what happened with COVID, we thought it was going backwards, it went forwards. We could assume that it's going a 24% increase and it actually doesn't. We can't predict the market because there's just too many factors. People are like, oh, they were going to have influx of, you know, migrations coming in, the government's letting in all these people, we need workers. And I, as I just said, they turned off the tap. Next thing you know, they're going to put a tax on investors every time they buy more than one property. Every property after that, the tax is increasing. You just don't know what's around the corner. For a hot second there, your ex-premier was going to put a land tax on amalgamated land value on all investment properties around Australia. And a lot of investors shaking in their little booties. Before it didn't fall through, but before that announcement, people were like, invest. Like it's the government can come in, policy can come in, things can change very quickly. That's why we can't ever assume to predict the future. It's a line in the sand before and not a single grain of sand after. And that's how we address our reports. If you bother to read the fine print, a valuation can only be relied upon for 3 months after the vow. That's why you got your pre-approval because the bank, so we say, yeah, this is good for 3 months. After 3 months, the market could change. When COVID hit, fun fact, we said this vow's only valid for today because we don't know what's happening tomorrow.
Really?
Yeah. So extend it for 3 months. We highly recommend that you do it after 3 months. But if you want to rely on this report, rely on it today. We're not guaranteeing tomorrow. It was something that the API put together, which is our governing body, the Australian Property Institute. We chuck it into all our reports.
As best practice to protect everybody.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we're like, good luck.
So we've been going over time, I don't want to keep you for too much longer. I've got really a couple more questions to go that I was really hoping we could touch on. For your report, you can't predict the future. Mm-mm. But for the podcast, are you prepared to share what you think this holds for the next 12 months?
The next 12 months are going to be interesting. People are talking about rate cuts. I don't see the rates being cut. And I think a lot of our market is thinking that if the rates cut, we will increase another 20-24%. I think that I just think inflation is, there's still, like, as you said, a lot of money out there still circulating. I don't think we're seeing that plateau or get to the number that the Reserve Bank want us to get to, that kind of Goldilocks 2-3% mark. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What I am seeing though is a slowing down in spending, in the economy. I feel like people are been running a marathon, they're feeling exhausted. So I'm hoping that the market will stabilize. And the reason I'm hoping it'll stabilize is it won't ever go back. I don't think it'll go back this year because property, as you know, is a game of supply and demand. If you don't have enough supply and you've got a lot of demand, then the demand will always want to pay more for the supply because they want to get their hands on it. Okay. Mm-hmm. If we start seeing supply enter into the market, then and it will outweigh the demand, I think the market will stabilize and come back. But if we if you're still going to open homes and you're saying to your friends and, you know, the family barbecue, there's nothing out there, the market's still going to continue to creep up.
That's what's protected us. And that's my opinion. My two bobs as not, you know, as just kind of my take is what's protected the market over the past 12 months from this decline that, you know, people again thought would happen with the increase of interest rates was that lack of supply. And I think a lot of people during COVID, that same mindset of like, hold on to their property, don't move, I don't want to lose, that same mindset in homeowners has continued. And I think what's then perpetuated the problem is as a homeowner, when I'm going out speaking to a vendor about thinking about selling their house, I'm like, Brennan, I'm not putting my house on the market till I secure another property. I don't know what's going to happen if I sell. So it's kind of compounding and it's contracting 100%. Tighter. It's like this, the spring is getting pulled in more and more and more because they're reluctant to put their house on the market. So then what happens is the other homeowner that's down the road that wants to upgrade, he doesn't want to sell either because he can't see where he can go to. And it's just compounding, 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 compounding.
150%, yeah. And I think this is not normal circumstances. This is not a normal. So we're talking about markets going up and going down. And then when you step back and have a look, it just looks like normal market transactions. We had a dip because of COVID, then it went up and then it corrected and it went up again. So our grandchildren are going to look back on this and go, oh, look what the market did. But then I'm going to be like, oh, let me tell you why that happens, you know, and put my teeth back in. And I will tell you that during that time, children, that was a point in time where we came out of COVID. I survived. Yes, I'm.
There was no robots and AI, you know, laser beams fighting each other. You know, that was when people did stuff and walked around.
Yeah, you know, we used to have people valuing homes back then, not robots. And that was me, me and your grandpa. My husband's not a value, but you know what I mean. And I'd be like, was a moment in time. And I want you to close that book and put it up on the shelf because those circumstances aren't normal circumstances. This is a pressure cooker situation. As you said, this market right now is so highly strung on lack of stock, oversupply, people still getting money, desperate for an investment. You know how much equity is in homes out there? Do you know how much money is in equity?
Tons.
That's what's fueling this investment craze at the moment.
The amount of appraisals, I'm on the Gold Coast, the amount of appraisals that I'll go into with this little old man, Nana and Pop, rattling around in this waterfront ginormous mansion that they paid, you know, 4 raspberries and 2 butterflies for, and it's in, and they live in one little room. They kind of crotchety come out of one room to the kitchen. That's all they do. It's worth, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5 million. And but they haven't got a lot of money. They're self-funded retirees, but they're all this capital, all this cash sitting in this property that they're never going to transact. The day that they, you know, God forbid, pass, the kids are going to go, you beauty. You know, all that money, there's stacks of it in homes out there.
Yeah, and this is where we're going to have the haves and the haves not, you know. Mm-hmm. And what I worry is our generation are going to get this money. And I don't blame the boomers for, you know, everyone's like, oh, the bloody boomers, they, you know, they bought it for 4 raspberries and 3 butterflies. They did, but they didn't want much from life. We want everything. Like the way my grandmother lives, Brennan, I cannot tell. My background's Macedonian. She was an immigrant. She came here, couldn't speak English. She raised, my mom came here. She was in primary school. You know, the typical story, like every other person that came to Australia, whether you came as a convict or you came on a boat or a plane, everyone came from somewhere, right? And she goes for 4 years, she paid her home off. And you think, oh, who can pay? Mate, if I tell you she spent $1.25 a week on a bag of beans and she fed her damn family on that bag of beans. If I tell my mum, you bring up that, it's called graf, anybody listening? And she, mum's like, if I hit graf one more time, it's taking me back to childhood. She made her own toy. She goes, your grandmother would make us clothes, and the straps, like the rags that were left over, I would take them, and me and your auntie would sit there and stitch as like 8-year-old kids. And I never had a doll. And I remember somebody bought me a doll and I was crying because I was like, oh, I got a doll. And I look at my daughter, she's got a bucket of Barbies. She's got 15,000 Care Bears. Like, we are for nothing. Like, she didn't have aircon. She didn't have security. She didn't have bench tops. She didn't have, my grandmother said, your grandfather found a tire, so he made something out of the tire. He found some spare wood, so he made something out of the wood. We're not like that. If it's marginally broken or outdated, we replace it. Her house has still got stuff in there from forever. Why? No, bro. I'm not throw. It's no break, you know? Okay. Like, you walk into my in-laws, it's the same. She's my mother-in-law. She goes, ah, you know, 30 years ago, Spiro have name day. Everybody bring present. And she opens this cupboard, and I swear to God, it's like coffee cups and cutlery. She's like, everybody, you don't come not present. You bring something, you know? It's just a little gift. She's got a whole thing of, and then she goes, I just use. Like, they're not like us. Like, if our generation gets this inheritance, some of us will invest it. Others like, ah, oh, new car, go on a holiday. Ah, oh, I've always wanted a Gucci bag. I'll just go and buy one. And then whatever's left over, I might put it away. And there's not really much at the end of it. My mum's like, if I ate KFC once a month, I felt guilty because I was like, I wasn't eating at home. Very different mindset. Secondhand cars, you know, I don't have to explain. There was no eating out. We had a local Chinese place that we went to once in a special occasion. My kids eat twice a week out. Oh, we're just catching up with some friends. We'll go to the local, you know, whatever. Oh, that one's got a new playground. We'll go check it out with the kids. It's a very different life. And I think we don't blame them for that. We are the ones that, and you know what else, Brennan? I know we're going over time. Think about this. I thought about this the other day. So I am copywriting this. This is my own thought. I'm like, my mum got married at 21, 22, but it was very normal back then. Everybody got married at 21, 22. She had a sister that was 24 and they were like, oh, she's getting on a bit. She better hurry up. So if everybody got married at 21, 22 and they all bought their properties, medium age was, I think, 26, they're very low down in their income earning capacity, right? And everyone had kids early, so it was only one income. So properties are only worth, this is what gets me back to the wage, it's only worth what you're about to pay for it. So you had sort of dad working, mum maybe part-time, maybe not, one income. So you can only afford to buy with one income. Australiana, suburbana. Homes were only three bedrooms, one bathroom. We didn't have these, you know, Netflix, we didn't have internet, we didn't have, I'm not saying we have to get rid of that. We had one car. So then all of a sudden comes the kind of late, like the 90s, women are like, I'm going to work, you know, women's rights, women's power, all that, fine. Women started working. My mum was a full-time worker. All of a sudden, people are getting married later. And now all of a sudden you've got two incomes. Okay, you've got two incomes. I'm slightly progressed in my career. I'm going to afford to pay more. The incomes contribute to this. Come the early 2000s, the Gen Xers, they're the kids of the boomers, right? They maybe get some inheritance from the grandparents, not much, very small value. And all of a sudden, they're like, oh, who gets married in the early 20s? I want to gap year. I want to travel. I want to do this. I want to do that. Then they don't get married to their 30s and they don't have kids until their 30s. Median age now for the first home is 36. Median age now for the first child is 32. At 32, my first job, I was earning $45,000. By 32, I was probably hitting 100, 110. Yeah?
I see where you're going. It's kind of like it's the household money has increased because of that change in society, which yes. means that people have more, and that's that driver is yep. what's pushed up prices. And
the 20-year-olds now, they don't want family homes. You tell me a 22-year-old.
They're not even moved out at 22. Yeah.
So all of a sudden, we've just money-coddled our 20-year-olds, where, like I said, they were going to my mum, your 24-year-old sister's getting on a bit, when is she getting married? And now all of a sudden, we are 20, 32, 33, 34. This millennials are the biggest age generation at the moment. We are the children of the boomers. The boomers were the biggest. We've now taken over because they've sadly, you know, dwindled in numbers. And we are brought up like Laurie, like that L'Oreal, like I'm worth it. I want a two-story house. My mum has a two-story. Well, my mum started in living with my in-laws, with my grandparents in a little, like at the back of the house. Then they moved into a two-bedroom home. Then they moved into a three-bedroom home. And then she moved into a nice house. But we want to start at the nice house. We forget there's hard work that comes to that. So I'm not saying that we have done this to ourselves, but instead of this is what we do, we look at and we blame the government and we blame the boomers. I'm not saying it's that, but I'm like, internalize that a little bit. Let's analyze and see what and how have we contributed. Like my grandmother's got aircon, barely puts it on. Oh, that's too much money. You know, me, I'm going to stop this interview to turn it on because I'm so precious. I'm like, oh, I'm feeling a bit hot. I just want to put the air conditioning on my hair, right? She's in the western suburbs. Like she'll sit there. It's like, oh, 40 degrees. All right, put it on, you know? And I'm like, you think? Here I'm like, oh, I'm just a bit uncomfortable and I put it on. But it's just how we are. So
it's funny how you explain that story, because as it's great, this interview, because as you're telling me these things, it's just reminding me of situations that I've been in myself. And I had a situation not so long ago, actually, with this lovely old lady, and she's rattling around in this big house and needs a stack of maintenance. It's old, but it's a big block, double brick, double story, huge, worth, say, $4 million. It's enormous. It's got this most gorgeous view of surface paradise. It's in a really high demand area, quiet street, stunning. And she was kind of like, you could tell that she just didn't have the money to do any of the maintenance. She's not running the aircon. She's living off, you know, basically nothing, like she always has.
Yeah.
And I said to her, you know, if we get this property sold for you, we can get you into a gorgeous, you know, modern property that's in fantastic condition. You got to have plenty of money in the bank that you can go on that trip you've always wanted. And, you know, you're not going to want for anything. And your golden years, you can really enjoy it because I can, you know, you're going to have lots of money.
Yeah.
And the look on her face was like, it just wasn't, she just didn't like, it was like it didn't care. It just couldn't get it. And I'm like, but you will have, you know, like as us, like in our generation, it'd be like, take the cash. You know, like get the money, like enjoy this time. But she's lived like a, probably the pauper's the wrong word. I can't think of another word, but lived so
humble,
frugally and humble for such a long time.
Yeah.
Even given the opportunity at her elderly age on her own as a widow, still can't enjoy that experience because 100%. It's just so foreign to them in their generation.
My grandmother's the only person that loves the government because she gets a pension. Plenty money. All right. Mate, she's got like her grandkids, $100 in that envelope every year, you know, and she puts it in there and she's, and I'm like, we say Baba. I'm like, Baba, it's too much money. What are you doing? All right. The government give me money. I got plenty of money. Don't worry. She goes 1,100 every 2 weeks. Do you know how much money that is? I don't need nothing. She's got a garden in the back. She's 88. She maintains her garden. She cuts her own lawn. Like she's a beast of a woman. If I'm anything like her, but she just does for nothing. She still makes the same beans for $1.75, you know. So she just very, very frugal. She doesn't want much. She doesn't care.
Yeah, it's, and I think you're spot on. And I think it's really interesting how society's changed over time, how we perceive value, what we do with our money, all those sorts of things. The advice that we can have access to now, like, you know, professionals like yourself or producing courses that you can do online that you can just plug into. You know, our nanas couldn't have access to that kind of information. And so I think it's such a different time now. And I think property you know, has stayed that stake in the ground during that process, but how we perceive the value of it has changed over the years. And I think it's really interesting to sort of get your sort of, you know, your feelings on that and to hear that story, I think is really interesting. So what I thought we might do is at the end of every podcast, we like to get to know our guests a little bit better. We have a little quiz at the end,
let's do it,
which is around your favorites. And so I thought we'd get right into it to wrap things up. What is your favorite movie?
A Beautiful Life.
Favorite food?
Prawns. Anything with prawns or seafood. Prawns.
Oh, me too.
Yeah,
me
I love
too.
Prawns.
Favorite
love
holiday destination?
Favorite holiday destination?
Yeah.
I've been to or I want to go?
Either. Want to go.
Okay. Favorite holiday destination would have to be my honeymoon. We went to Bora Bora.
Yes.
Worth the hype, worth the money, worth everything. Amazing. I really want to take the kids to Japan.
Yeah,
I want to go to Japan.
To go to the snow or the city?
Maybe both, and maybe like a sounds so commercial, but I wouldn't mind taking them to Disneyland. To like Asia, Disneyland Asia, yeah.
Most embarrassing moment that you are game enough to share?
This is going way back. I was a kid and it still stays with me. I was probably like leaving like the year six, going into year seven, and we went on holidays and you started to, I can't believe I'm telling this story. And I was starting to notice like boys and they were looking at me and I was like, maybe they like me. And one comes over and is like, I think your costume's see-through. And I've gone, and I ran out, died. I cannot tell you that. Shame and that embarrassment has stayed with me to this day. They're like, we can see everything. And I just went, tears, because it's like you're coming out of that kind of, you know, and you're aware. Yeah, freak, like, stays with me.
Do you know what's interesting? Whenever I ask that question, it always goes back to school. Like, it's you know, and everyone says it stayed with me. It's kind of like horrifying, those things.
Yeah, that stayed with me.
What does a typical day for you look like?
First and foremost, I'm a mum, so I have to get my little munchkins dressed, ready, sandwiches. Until they are done, my day doesn't start. So once I get them at school and I'm like, see ya, and then I'm like, right, now my day starts. And then I love what I do because no 2 days are the same. I might have a valuation. I might do a depreciation. I might do a podcast. I might do some social media. I might do anything and everything. I'm like the guy in Mary Poppins who has the harmonica and the drum and the cymbals and he's Dick Van Dyke and he's just doing like one man band. That's me. So I do it all and then it all kind of stops and I go pick up the kids. And then they come home, but I pick them up once or twice a week. And then like wife and mum kick in because I got to do the housework and all that. But during the time it's me, everything and anything, I just cram it in and do it. And just like everybody.
It's a million miles an hour. The kids, and they're just like, take off and knock it all out as fast as you can. Yeah.
And then at school, I'm like, see ya. And then I'm out. And I'm just doing whatever.
Yeah. If you could have dinner with any inspirational person, dead or alive, who would it be?
Inspirational person, dead or alive. I lost my dad. I'd love to see my dad again. It was 10 years ago. And he is a huge inspiration in my life, and he never met my kids, so I'd like him for one day back. He's sort of famous. Well, long story. He played with AC/DC as one of their very first drummers when he was in high school. Like, he was very young. Like, I act as if he was part of the band, but he wasn't. But he did play with them, so it's worth something. I don't know who I'd love to sit down with. I'll come back to you.
That's okay. Biggest regret?
Biggest regret. You always think that things shape you, so you kind of like don't have any regrets because you, since this is property, there's always that home I wish I bought. Like, should have bought that, should have done this.
Yeah.
I think it always comes back to finances. I never regret my life, but there's always like, oh, if only we did it this way, because hindsight, right? How good's hindsight? Mm. So I probably shouldn't have sold that when I did. I probably should have bought that when I had the chance. So I think it would, for me, being in property, I think my biggest regrets always come when you drive past and you, I don't know if your parents ever did that. My parents were investors growing up and they'd be like, oh, we nearly bought that. And they'd be like, Sue, remember we nearly bought that for this much? And then I was like at the back going, oh, I hate hearing these stories. But now here I am saying, I wish we did that. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're right. It's kind of that circumstance at the time, you know, like it's, I get that a lot as well in my industry. Oh, I wish I did this. I wish I did that as well. But my biggest regret was selling that too soon. If I would have held it for another, I'm like, well, there was a reason why you moved. Okay, it's done. It's all in the past. Get over it. Most thankful for?
My kids, my two kids. For a while there, I didn't know if I could have kids. I had to do IVF. And then when my son came, to this day, I am so damn thankful for my family every day.
Amazing.
So, and they're healthy, and I'm thankful for that because a lot of people aren't that lucky.
That's all we ask for, right?
That's it. That's all. I don't care. I'd give it all up. Like, honestly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I'm thankful.
If you were Prime Minister for the day, what's one thing you would change?
What are these questions?
They're tough ones, hey?
I would change, since it's in property, I would change land. I would change stamp duty.
Right.
I'd change stamp duty. I think it is not fair that when it was put in place, homes were only worth $100,000 and it was such a small percentage. Now, when you have economies of scale, it's a big chunk. Like, and it's just a money grab. So I would do something with stamp duty because within this property and I can't be bothered with everything else. And free dental. I think we need free dental. I think actually before property, maybe we leave the stamp duty, but I feel like we need a bit more funds into Medicare. Doctors aren't bulk billing anymore. I don't know what's happening there. At least free
dental. I've noticed that there's in our area, like all the bulk billing doctors are all switched to
scrap that about the property, stuff it. You're paying your stamp duty, probably increase it now because I want more money. So sucked in, taking it all back. I'm Prime Minister, I can do what I want, and I'll help fix our, I'll give the nurses more money. I will pledge for the hospitals. And the teachers, I think all the government, like if you're an essential worker doing what you can to raise the society, mate, take care of your family because they're our family.
Yeah.
Family care for you. Nurses care for you in the hospital. So take care of them.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people would agree with you on that too.
Right, Belinda Botsolis. You know how they have that?
Yeah.
The Botsolis party in Sydney.
If the audience wants to get in touch with you to engage your services, to support them to make the right property decisions, or perhaps they would like to, participate in your course that you mentioned that you've recorded and that's coming up soon. What's the best way for the audience to get in contact with you?
You probably forget the name, but you won't forget the valuer. So if you type in Belinda the valuer, or you go on any type of social media and you're just like, that valuer girl, the girl, the chick, the lady that did, she's the valuer. If you somehow Google the valuer, I pop up.
So is that why you called yourself the valuer? Because you thought that'd be a great way to, for people to remember. Or that just happened.
Can I tell you why? True story. I started TikTok, and at the time, TikTok was just for teenagers dancing. Yeah.
Did you do dances?
No. And I was like, oh my God, I would. Because you got to imagine how professional and how top button valuers are, right? These people are like very conservative. And I was like, I will not be caught dead on TikTok. But I want to share my knowledge, and I want to just, because there's so much. Anyway, I just went, I don't want people to know my name. I don't know, want them to know where I work. So I just called myself the valuer.
It's like a clandestine thing.
Yeah. I didn't put my name. I didn't say where I worked. I didn't say where I was from. I didn't say Sydney, Melbourne. I was like this. I didn't want to be the person. I just wanted to give the information.
So was your socials before you started your business?
Yeah. That's why I started my business. I started my business because I would get that many comments and messages and saying, hey, I just need to talk to someone about this. Do you know anyone? I was like, actually, I don't. I can't. I'm trying to add value to my home, but I don't want to overcapitalize. It's so expensive. What I'm thinking of doing, I want to do this, this, and this. Am I going to add value? Am I wasting my money? And I'm like, I can help you. So then I turned to my husband. I was like, babe, do you reckon they'll pay if I ask them to? And he's like, yeah, I'd pay. So then I think my very first consult was like $200, and I spent like 2 hours with them on site, and I helped them and I gave them a valuation, and she gave me an extra $100. She goes, you've given me so much. I can't give you this, just this money. And I've gone, realistically, how much would you pay? And then she told me a figure, and then I worked with that. And then I just got feedback, and then now I found where I'm working. But that's how it started. It was like, can you review my floor plan? So cool. I want to buy this investment property. Is it a good one? I don't know. Should I buy? Should I sell? Should I hold? My nan wants to sell her waterfront mansion. The agent reckons $4 million. What do you think? And is there anything she can do to add value? She's wasting your money. See these type of questions? And then I went, I can't give this advice where I'm working, but if I work for myself, I can. And that's how it started.
So your business developed organically off the back of the awareness you'd created from your valuer account.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, boom, you're in business.
Yeah. So I had the audience, and then I had my business, where people start their business and try and grow their audience. So I did it the other way around, and I didn't mean to. I didn't want to. I had a really cruisy job. Valuers don't get paid much. So I was like in this job, I wasn't getting paid much, didn't care, but it was cool because I knew what I was doing. Being the tax agent, I felt like I had this advantage where I could.
And like that salary, it's that guaranteed money kind of just every, yeah. You know, this, that. And rather than the unknown of a business, but because you had that organic, that audience, those people just needing that advice, that you'd sort of earned the trust.
Yeah, and because I do a lot too, Brennan, because I do the valuations, I do tax depreciation being a tax agent, I do investment advice, and I do kind of renovation advice. I feel like I haven't pigeonholed myself in one. I kind of like bang, bang, harmonica. It's a little bit of everything. So, if I don't make any money from vows this month, I've got plenty of, you know, consults. If I don't make any consults, I've got 5 vows coming in. I don't know what each day or each week or each month kind of holds. And as, you know, business grows, you get word of mouth, you get, you know, and it just organically grows. That outside of the social media, it grows organically itself.
Through referrals and traditional business.
Yeah. You know, I do business networking, women in business, all that stuff. Occasionally I get, you look familiar. Do I know you? And I'm like, maybe. Where? Like, we're just, I don't know, just like your voice sounds to me like, sorry, shit. You probably hear me all the time somewhere. So, yeah.
I'll put all your links below as well. So if you do want to get in touch, you can have all the information you need to find Belinda and her website and services and all of her social media accounts. And thank you so much for joining the show.
Thank you. We got there in the end.
Yeah. It's our longest episode yet. But it just, the time flew.
Yeah.
I think.
Sorry, not sorry. You got some pretty good info there, guys. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, it was really cool. And I think anybody listening would get a lot of value from what we discussed today. So I do really appreciate you with all your clanging and banging that you've got going on, that you found an hour or so to share your wisdom with us. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.